Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodishenesi from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really looking forward to this conversation with an absolutely dynamic individual, Andrew McLuhan, who helps people, individuals and groups, gain fresh perspectives on the personal and social consequences of technologies using McLuhan methods, workshops, lectures, classes for individuals or groups. If you want to know what McLuhan did or how he did it, then talk to Andrew, which I intend to do right now. So go on then, Andrew. Hi, and how are you?
Hi, Sean. I'm very well. Oh, well, you know what? I'm a little discombobulated, to tell you the truth. I was in Washington, D.C. on the weekend and am recovering.
Yeah.
I was at a conference organized around the work of French-American philosopher René Girard. Right. And it was my first serious exposure to his work. And a lot to think about.
Go on then, far away.
Oh, well, you know, I was invited to be part of it by the one and only Luke Burgess. Mm-hmm. To bring some McLuhan thought to the discussion. And it was curious to look into it because Marshall was older than René, but they were contemporaries of a sort.
Yep.
And it's odd because they had slightly parallel paths in that Marshall came to media studies through English literature, mm-hmm. and René Girard came to his work through French literature, well, through literature, let's say. Mm-hmm. Although Marshall was a trained literary critic and René was a sort of self-taught literary critic or accidental, which I love, by the way.
Yes.
But where they overlap and yet don't overlap is in this concept or idea of mimesis.
Right.
And this was one of Girard's key concepts. On desire, human desire and wanting as a key to human behavior, in a large part, that mm-hmm. We want or we desire things because we see other people with them or wanting or desiring them. And this goes to explain a lot of things about human behavior. And Marshall also used this concept of mimesis. It's a very old word and idea. It's nothing new, Latin or Greek, maybe a bit of both. So Marshall broke it down into actually two categories, one of matching and one of making. This was his shorthand for talking about mimesis. And in matching, he's speaking about imitating, miming, you know, matching, as you imagine a mime kind of miming what you're doing, matching, imitating. Making, however, goes much deeper. And in the making, and we're going into metaphysics here, yeah, actual transformation, he arrives at this partly through another thinker named Eric Havelock. And Havelock wrote a few books, notably one called Preface to Plato. Yeah. And Preface to Plato looks at the mind of the Greeks as literacy, phonetic literacy, the written word, via the phonetic alphabet comes into being. And shows what the state of mind and the state of affairs were before the alphabet, when not the written word, but the poets ruled, oral culture. Mm-hmm. And this was a very different world than the world for the next 2,500 years, because in pre-literacy, cultural transmission happened mainly through the poets. And the poets would deliver their poems, their epics, for even hours at a time. And to listen to it was to become it. So you didn't just hear a story about Achilles. You became Achilles. You were part of the story in very fundamental ways. And so this is not imitation. It's becoming. It's transformation. And this is how you could hear it once and recite it forever after. It requires a total loss of objectivity and a total involvement. And this is the mimesis that Marshall talks about when he talks about becoming and making over matching. And where he found it useful in his work was he posited that so literacy in the phonetic alphabet broke this spell of mimesis by introducing objectivity and distance, reason, rationality, broke the mimetic spell. Well, when we lost literacy, when we lost the power of the phonetic alphabet, we returned to more of a pre-literate state. So mimesis comes on the rise again. Now, it's not one-to-one. It's not that we're going back in time. We're going forward into time. But the mode of experience has more in common with pre-literacy than with the period of literacy. So it's quite a lot. But So I went down to the conference to sit on a panel with some people and talk about the McLuhan perspective of mimesis, and had the wonderful opportunity to listen to all kinds of other people talk about Girard and his theories of mimetic desire and scapegoating, and find out more about this highly influential 20th century figure.
How fascinating. And there's been a lot of talk, certainly on this side of the Atlantic recently, because you're was in Canada and I'm in the UK, talking about one of the, to put it very bluntly, one of the real sort of impacts of particularly social media has been ourselves going to a sort of a pre-literary form, mm-hmm. culturally, because no one's reading anymore. No one's reading anything that has any length or any depth to it. So perhaps there's a link there. Have to mention, by the way, as I was doing my reading prior to this, with regards to both your grandfather and father, who we'll talk about obviously in a while. As Marshall said, nobody could pretend serious interest in my work who is not completely familiar with all the works of James Joyce and the French symbolists. So let's throw that one in. And then also, I think a really good point, this is quoting you back at you, I think, from one of your fairly early blogs, and you're talking about your father, Eric McLuhan, saying, in my opinion, as in your opinion, Eric's library is no less significant than Marshall's. I think I'm a bit like, I love this, I think I'm a bit like Socrates and Plato, or Plato and Aristotle, teacher and student both. I love that.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's an odd position to be in, Sean. I wouldn't have thought when I was a teenager that I would be here talking to you and that I would have said something like that 30 years later. Yeah. It's a little surreal, but life goes where it goes, and we follow or lead or a little bit of both. And here we are. Yeah. You know, my first major McLuhan project was in documenting and inventorying my grandfather Marshall's library,
yep.
Which is around 6,000 books. An Whoa. Annotated library. And it's interesting. It's not just that he marked up books, but, a lot of Marshall's genius was in taking other people's ideas and concepts in places they hadn't imagined, maybe didn't even want to go.
Yeah.
But of course, you know, people think when you write a book, when it's published, you're done. But that's not the case, actually. That's only the beginning. Mm. Books have lives of their own. And yep. One of the best parts of the book is the space between and before and after the words, because that's your space, you know. Marshall took full advantage of this space, and I'm sure a lot of the authors might have been horrified with what he did with their work. But, you know, Marshall took work of people like Harold Innes, like James Joyce, T.S. Yep. Eliot, and many others, and took them out of one field and into another with often surprising results, and very often surprising to him. You know, a large part of what he did was, as I kind of hinted at earlier, take the skills he learned for approaching and studying, criticizing literature, and applying them to technology and culture. And I'm sure he was quite amazed to find that they translated. You know, in around 2008-09, I did this project. It took me over a year, and honestly, I could still be doing it because it's fascinating. Mm. But by the end of it, I found myself pretty well hooked into the work, and it's an odd way to get to know somebody through the notes they make in the margins of their work.
Yeah, yeah.
I was only just over 2 years old when my grandfather died, so I immersed myself into the traces he'd left behind him in his book, you know, which is a record of his intellectual development and progress. It shows what he found interesting in other people's work. And because, you know, he revisited these works as well. And as we age, our handwriting changes. So you can see the notes he made when he was younger, and his writing was very flowing, and he wrote in more complete sentences. And as time get on, and it's get jerkier, and he uses short forms, M/M for the medium is the message.
Yeah.
So you can see, you know, how he came back 20, 30 years later and picked up stuff he didn't pick up on before. So it's a really interesting thing. And, you know, my father had a library of around the same size and scope, which I inherited after he died, and his library is now my library. His office is now my office, and it's quite a thing. A library, it can be very personal.
Mm.
And the wonderful thing about it for me is like Marshall's library, my father's library is also annotated. And you know, whenever I talk about this, I feel like I'm going a little esoteric. However, if you'll give me a little bit of leeway,
please do.
You know, they say if you weigh somebody just before and just after they die, there's a very, very small but measurable difference in weight, and they think this might account for the soul. Mm-hmm. Well, I think about this in relation to the library because, well, for one thing, it's infinitesimal. I mean, how much graphite is left on the page when you write a note, or how much ink? It's a very minuscule amount, but it is measurable, right? And if you're to add up the notes over 6,000 books, it becomes a little more significant. There's actual weight there. We leave traces of ourselves behind, and not just in that way, but I can't help but feel, this is the way I feel, and experience, that we leave more than just impressions in a page. You know, there are more traces of our curiosity, of our epiphanies, you know, contained in a library like that, something that's used so intimately and consistently over decades. So, you know, while my father may have died in 2018, I really believe I feel him in the library. And you know, shortly after his death, I was in a bit of despair because, of course, I'd only just started studying the work, and I have so many questions, and he's not around anymore to answer them. But he is, you know. He and Marshall left behind so much work that really the answers are there. Marshall, even you brought up Joyce. Marshall said at one point that he'd come up with a fresh discovery and think he was onto something new, only to turn to Finnegan's Wake and find out that Joyce had been there before him.
Very good.
So the answers are there, I think, which should be a comfort to all of us.
Yeah, exactly. And you say the answers are there, which also I think, without being too sort of glib after such a sort of a poetic sort of emotion, it is one of the, obviously the one of the many great sort of quotes that you see about sort of pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. So the answers are there if one looks for them. As watching the interview earlier on, I think you put up one of the obviously endless amounts of them of your grandfather interview with Norman Mailer when he talks about precisely that. So
I love that one.
Yeah, it's great, isn't it? I think something like the duty of the artist, et cetera, et cetera. Absolutely superb. And then meanwhile, so... And obviously, we'll go through this in more detail as the conversation develops. But if you like, leaping from the now and indeed the past, but into the future in terms of a very definite point on the horizon. So go on then, South by Southwest 2024.
Oh, and, wow.
The panel about identity and that issue, which I think at the moment, not only I think is you're talking about how technology is transforming identity, but if there is ever more of a serious cultural ground zero point than identity at the moment, then I'd like to think what it is. You can start an argument with anyone anywhere by just mentioning that word. So go on then. So what's the talk about the panel and who else is on it, et cetera?
It's hard to imagine a more consequential an important topic of our time than that of identity. A neighbor, maybe not a near neighbor, but a neighbor of yours, Tracy Follows.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure. She's
brilliant. Her work on identity is so important and it does not get nearly the attention it deserves, but it'll get there. She actually took my class on understanding media, and we developed a relationship from there, and proposed a panel for South by Southwest to talk about identity. Identity, actually, this comes back to the idea of mimesis as well. Identity and identification, it's such rich territory because who we are, how we identify, these things have very technological roots, and that becomes very pivotal in a time like ours when technological change happens so quickly. Mm-hmm. As far as mimesis goes, if you recall back to the pre-Socratics and to when the poets had the power, the listener identifies almost pathologically, is how Havelock put it, with what the listener is hearing, so that the listener becomes Achilles, the listener becomes Ulysses. In our time, the listener becomes, Kendrick Lamar, even though the listener lives in Picton, Ontario, or Brighton, UK. Not in South Central Los Angeles. But you can't tell them that. They don't want to hear it. And for all intents and purposes, it's true because it's their truth. And they're not imitating, they're not acting. This is who they are. This is their identity, and your identity is who you are. In very, very real senses. This is something that couldn't have happened 50 years ago. Or more, it has a lot to do with the technological environment and our makeup as human beings, our changing makeup. Tracy asks, can your identity survive the 21st century? I'm not sure your identity can survive the year, honestly. Things happen so fast. And from the McLuhan side of things, this comes down to what you mentioned briefly in the introduction, the personal and social effects of technologies.
Yep.
And Marshall broke it down, the effects of technologies, into these two categories, the personal, or sometimes he said psychic, and social. And what he meant by personal or psychic is that, you know, we as human beings are basically the sum total of our senses. Everything we know, every piece of data, every impression we receive comes through one or more senses, you know, and then is processed, and we form a picture, we form an opinion, we form an identity. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of that has to do what picture we form, what identity, what opinion we form, has very much to do with the nature of our senses. And the nature of our senses have very much to do with how they're formed, beginning with when we're children. And a person's senses are different today than they were when somebody grew up in television, when somebody grew up in radio, when somebody grew up before electricity, when somebody grew up before the written word. Very different people. Marshall found it very helpful when he learned about a book by another Frenchman, Jacques Lucyrin, who wrote a book called And There Was Light. And Lucyrin talked about how at a very young age, he became blind almost overnight. Within a period of days, he lost his sight. And he relates the story you hear from other people through this situation, that as their visual faculty dimmed, their other faculties perked up. Their sense of hearing became more acute, their sense of touch. Who you are as a person with vision is very different from who you are as a person without. You enjoy, you value different things. What does a blind person care about visual art? What do they care about fashion? Well, they might care a bit about these things, but it'll be different from what sighted people value. They're different people. So they naturally have different lives, different opinions, different values, right? Well, you can take this case because every technology affects our senses in one way or another. And what we know from Lucyrin and experience of people like that is that when you affect one sense, you affect all the senses, because our senses don't exist in isolation. They exist in a balance or a ratio. Yep. And who we are has a lot to do with what our sensory ratio is. So Marshall talks a lot about sensory ratios in his work, and this is what he's talking about, that any new technology that comes along affects our senses, affects these sensory ratios, and that creates a new human, a new individual, that creates a new society, a new culture. These are the major personal and social consequences of technologies, and have everything to do with our values and our identities.
Whoa.
This was Marshall's point about how we treat technologies, is that this aspect of technology is almost universally ignored because it has nothing to do with the content of the technology, you know, and has everything to do with the nature of the technology. So we could be talking over Zoom, catching up about local gossip, or we could be having a discussion about, you know, media studies or whatever else, the big orange guy down south. The fact is our senses are being affected by the technology. The content is kind of the delivery mechanism.
And wasn't this his point about the light bulb analogy?
Yes.
Yeah.
Another way to say this is the medium is the message.
Yeah.
But when we in our discussions about AI and anything else that's happening, media literacy doesn't really take this into account. So it's how can we talk about ethical technology when we don't take into account the reshaping of our senses and sensory ratios and what that does to us? I don't think we can really have those discussions until we can confront these fundamental facts.
Yeah, yeah. How interesting. And it also gives me a chance to come out with the epic quote. As the great man said, in a culture like ours, long accustomed to splitting and dividing all things as a means of control, it's sometimes a bit of a shock to be reminded that, in operational and practical fact, the medium is the message. linking absolutely to that, again, back to your forthcoming panel at South by Southwest about identity, I think it's interesting, I mean, of the many, many viewpoints on this at the moment, a couple of interesting ones, I think, of the moment. So Trevor Phillips, ex-head of the Commission for Racial Equality in the UK, very good piece today in the Times talking about the appalling reality now in Gaza. You know, this war has exposed the worst in tribalism. He talks about identity spikes. As he puts it, the moment when a single thing about us so constrains our lives that nothing else counts, and the problems arise when what one attributes to starts to dominate all others in spite of your own wishes. So a really interesting view that he takes on it there, along with Yasha Monk. I mean, his book, The Identity Trap, A Story of Ideas and Power in Our Time. Of all the viewpoints on that, I think just to mention one of them, that as a review say, you know, he's built his acclaimed scholarly career and one of them being the first to warn of the risks that right-wing populists pose to American democracy. But he also focuses on those on the left and the center who are stuck in the identity trap and are now inadvertent allies to the MAGA movement. Hmm. There we are.
Well, nothing quite gets us worked up as much as a threat to our identity.
Mm.
Marshall talked a lot about this. He said, you know, violence is always a quest for identity. This is why we live in such unhappy times, because every time we turn around, our identity is thrown to the wolves. You know, and the overarching narrative, the happy story we wish we could believe, was that, you know, your life is a quest to find out your identity, as if it's one thing. Well, it's no more one thing than you're going to have one career and retire at 55. You know, it's simply not the case, because every technology reshapes you and you adjust, and you're a new person. You create a new identity, or one is created for you. So, you know, it's thrust upon us, whether we want it or not. I was just going to say that Tracy and I had Tracy really, credit where credit's due, she proposed the panel. I just said, I'd love to do it with you. but she did the legwork. Unfortunately, we haven't heard that it was picked. So I don't think we are going to South by Southwest.
What? Which is an outrage.
It's as I said, I think it is really the pivotal question of our time. However, I guess it wasn't quite pivotal enough for Austin.
Well, in that case, I think we all need to get online or via any other method, as we say, or platform or indeed media, and insist that panel gets a bit back on.
By all means.
yeah, totally. I mean, on that point, again, I think the point you're just making there about that, I mean, surely, again, this is absolutely all about authenticity. Nietzsche, that the Nietzschean view that, the question, you know, is the authentic us, the authentic me, the person that I was when I was born, or do I develop through time? And that fascinating viewpoint, I think, we had of the many of them viewing oneself as a sort of work in progress, as a work of art. So you don't just it's not stuck in sort of at a particular moment in time. One is
right, and you know, Marshall McLuhan lived at the end of an age and the dawn of another.
Yes,
He wasn't too happy about it. Honestly, he was a really conservative person who insisted he just wanted to be left alone. My father was the same way. My dad would rather not go out and give speeches and stuff. He really just wanted to sit in his office and explore, read and write and do the fun work. I, on the other hand, grew up, I'm a poet by nature, maybe of the old kind, I don't know. But I've always loved words. I've always loved crafting poetry. I've always loved performing. So I love going out and giving talks and speeches and stuff as much as I love exploring and doing that stuff too. But to Marshall's point, he was asked if there was any age he would rather live in other than his own. And he basically said, I'd rather live in any age where they're just willing to leave things alone for a while. And the interviewer said, but they're not going to, are they? And he replied, no, they're not. And so we have no choice except to try and understand what's going on because, as he said, I refuse to simply sit back and let the juggernaut roll over me. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting position. It becomes more and more difficult these days as we said, you know, at every turn, there's something new. I mean, just in the last couple of years, we've gone since COVID, our world has changed a few times over. And this is both a blessing and a curse because Marshall liked to bring up Bertrand Russell, who said, if they only raise the temperature of the bathwater by a degree every hour, we wouldn't know when to scream.
Yeah.
So the thing about, you know, the way of life hundreds, thousands of years ago is that change happens so slowly that we had time to adjust and we didn't have time to notice. Well, now we don't have time to adjust. And so it's as if we were to stick our toes in a boiling cauldron rather than a lukewarm bath. We know something's wrong, even if we don't know exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one wonders which point in time that perhaps Marshall was focusing on when things were perhaps more static than they are now. But again, that's back to Heraclitus and change and up to Karl Popper and all the rest in terms of there is never, things don't stand still, stepping in rivers twice, etc. And then what about, just to go back to your own personal work, but separately to this, you say. So go on then. So your book, so, you know, Written Matter and Maelstrom Escape Strategies. Perhaps just talk about those in some detail.
Oh, sure. Written Matter was a kind of happy accident. As I said, I'm a poet. I can't help it. It's my nature.
Yeah.
And it's I think my, if I think about it, it's what I've been interested in and consistent about the longest in my life, from probably before I could write. I was interested in words and rhyme and poetry and poetic expression, you know, distilling things. And it was kind of my little pandemic thing. But so where I live, we live in, my wife and I bought my parents the old homestead here a couple of years ago. And there's a main house, which is like an 1870s farmhouse. And then there's a similar vintage two-story barn about 40 paces up the drive.
Nice.
Which was converted to my father's library and archive. It's very nice. It is. I'm very spoiled. And it sits on just about 2 acres in between farms in Prince Edward County in Southern Ontario. And so, you know, being confined to quarters for us meant something different than you in Brighton or someone in inner city New York or anywhere else.
Sure.
It was, you know, maybe a little more bearable. But I got into the habit of going out to the office in the morning with my coffee, and on the way I'd take a picture of something. One of my other passions is street art and graffiti. And what I love about street art, what I love about what Banksy and other people like that do sometimes is they point out things which are there but are overlooked. So my reaction to that is to try and look for the overlooked. So I'd go out to my office with my phone camera, and I'd try to see something in a different way. Take a close-up photo of something that's there that I wouldn't normally pay attention to. And then I'd sort of prop that up and use that as a writing prompt. And I started to amass quite a collection of poems that way. And someone I know, Jen Zart, who runs Revelor Press, because I would post the picture and the poem on Facebook or Instagram or whatever. And she said, hey, you've got a good thing going there. Can we publish them? To which, you know, obviously, you want to publish a book. Let's do that. Yeah. So we published this book. It was very limited edition, but I think there are still some copies available through Revelor Press. You can order them. that was a lovely project, which I wish I still did that every day, but I don't quite every day. Maelstrom Escape Strategies is something a little different. Marshall, speaking of how he used other people's work, one of the enduring stories, ideas, metaphors he employed was from Edgar Allan Poe. Mm-hmm. Actually, he got a lot from Edgar Allan Poe. You know, James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, Eliot, these people get a lot of the spotlight. But Poe was very important to McLuhan. Poe is credited with inventing the modern detective novel. And with his character, Dupin. And Marshall likened his work to a detective as well. He said, I begin with effects and I work back to causes. Mm. And this was to use the model of the detective, who in the cliche detective novel, the scene opens with a body or some mystery to be solved. And the rest of the book is kind of following the train backwards to find out what happened, to, you know, pick up the clues and put them together to form the puzzle. So you begin with the effect and you work backward to causes. And this is how Marshall studied technology. He looked around at him and he saw the effect. This is what's happening. And he worked backwards to try and figure out what caused it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Poe also had a story called A Descent into the Maelstrom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely short story. And Marshall used it as early as his first major book, The Mechanical Bride, Folklore of Industrial Man, in 1951. He opens in the preface talking about this. And it's a theme throughout the rest of his work over the next three decades. And in Poe's story, there's a sailor, a fisherman, and he and his brother, they live somewhere in the North Atlantic there. And, you know, there's this giant maelstrom, this whirlpool in the ocean, and everybody knows it's there, and you stay clear of it or you're in trouble. So seems pretty simple. Steer clear of it, you're okay. However, the best fishing is on the other side of it. But you have to be pretty crazy because you can get through, but you have to time it just right. And if you're off a minute or two either side, you're done. But if you get through there, you can do like a week's worth of fishing in a day. So these guys, you know, were doing this and it all went well until it didn't, as you can imagine. One time they're heading back and they timed it wrong and they get sucked in. And one of the brothers is lost overboard immediately, and another one loses his mind and he's pretty much done. But the narrator, the sailor, says that after the initial terror wears off, he started to look around him and study the action of the forces in which he was involved. And because this maelstrom was so huge, they're going around and around and around, and it's taking a long time before they actually get sucked in and crushed at the bottom. Mm. So the sailor manages to achieve some kind of calm state after the terror wears off, notices that certain objects in this vortex behave a little differently, and instead of going down, 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 appear to be going up, up, up. And well, this is interesting. So he pays a little closer attention and thinks he sees some things in common here. He employs some pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. And he thinks maybe if he does this and if he times it just right and jumps overboard, he might be able to get out of this thing. So he does. And he jumps overboard just as you know, his craft takes the final leap over the abyss. And sure enough, the sailor's carried up and out and lives to tell the tale, whether or not people believe him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Marshall used this as a metaphor to our technological circumstance. We're involved in these maelstroms of our own making, these technological vortices. And perhaps by studying the action of these things, we might plot some strategies of escape.
Mm.
And, you know, this always kind of stuck with me. And I thought, yeah, you know, maelstrom escape strategies. Well, how do we do that? Marshall, you know, thanks for pointing it out, but how do we do it?
Mm.
So I got a grant from this guy, Reggie James in New York, who runs a company called Eternal. And they do great work, and they really support arts and the artists. They empower artists. And we got involved in some discussions, and he liked the idea and gave me a little grant that allowed me to do some research into it. And I came up with maybe a formula for it. And it's a three-part thing.
Mm-hmm.
Survive, escape, avoid.
Mm.
So the first thing, should you find yourself in a maelstrom, Sean, the first thing you want to do is survive, right?
Yep.
So you want to get out of the thing. So you survival is primary. So that's, you know, grabbing something to hold on to catch your breath, to be able to get over the terror and look around you.
Mm.
Once you've kind of done that, you need to escape. So you need to actually do some things, because wanting to escape is not going to help you escape. You have to actually do something about it, right? It's great to come up with ideas, but actions are required. And should you survive, should you escape, it's probably best to not jump into the next vortex you come across, right? Because every time we turn around, there's another one. So survive, escape, avoid. And it's kind of a short essay, or a short book, or a long essay. And I've given presentations on it in New York and San Francisco, which were a lot of fun.
Mm.
But haven't managed to publish it yet. The key part about it is for it to be a guidebook, because the difficult thing is there's only so much you or I can do, you know. It's Marshall McLuhan and Buckminster Fuller and W.H. Auden were having a debate on television where Auden says, I don't have a television and I wouldn't dream of having one. And Marshall says, well, you merely suffer the consequences without enjoying any of the benefits. So, you know, you can throw away your smartphone, maybe. I don't know. I can't. But you still live in the world of the smartphone. Still, you know, it might be a good, if you can live without the smartphone, maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. But what I wanted to focus on was escape strategies that anybody can do, because it's only a very privileged person that can, you know, get rid of their smartphone, you know, and opt out. Most people need them for day-to-day life. So what can we do? Well, one of the things I suggest is a big part of the difficulty people have these days is that it's just so fast, you know?
Yep.
And one of the major consequences of this speed is anxiety. People are very anxious, very stressed out. And how do you alleviate that? Well, there are some ways, actually. And here's one of the ways. So, I did some experiments, and I found that I speak at around 140 words a minute, and I type at about 80 words a minute, and I write at about 40 words a minute by hand. I'm not sure how fast I type on my typewriter. I should do that next. But this actually came to me when I was driving across the country, and when you go through the mountains, you see these signs that say trucks use lower gear. Because if you put your truck in a lower gear, if you slow the engine, you slow the truck. Well, this kind of works on our mind too. Because if you slow the hand, you slow the mind. That is, so I suggest people try spending 15 minutes a day, really 15 minutes, and write a page. Write a letter to somebody, write a list, a journal entry, a list of things you see around you. It's better to have a connected narrative because, because you have to slow your hand to keep pace, or rather you have to slow your mind to keep pace with your hand.
Yeah.
Right. And it might not sound like a lot, and it's not a lot, actually. This is why I suggest it, because it's achievable. Even a single parent with kids at home has 15 minutes somewhere in the day to do this. And I've had people do it and report back. And if you can do this through the week, over a couple of weeks, you notice a difference. It really does make a difference. This is also why I do my best to read as much on paper as I can, because your behavior when you read on paper is different than your behavior when you read on a screen. On the screen, your eye tends to move faster and to skip and skim and to kind of hunt for relevant information. And the page holds your eye and your attention a little more closely, and it slows it down a little bit. This is why, you know, when my son's teachers are, you know, giving them reading that they have to log into on the computer, it's all I can do to not have a conversation with them, you know? Oh God, here comes McLuhan, right? But, they're quite different things. And if you want the benefits of literacy, print-based literacy, you have to look at it on the page. It makes a very large difference. Yeah. This is fundamentals of technology.
Very, very interesting. As we said, also, just going back slightly on a couple of the points you made earlier on when you were talking about the story of the fishman and pattern recognition, have to use that opportunity to drop in that back in the day when the epic pattern recognition title came out of William Gibson, I interviewed him at that point for the media, and he came out with, again, the great quote from the book in the interview, that we've no genuine idea of what the future may hold because the present is too volatile. We've purely got the spinning of the given moments, scenarios, and risk management pattern recognition, hence the fisherman. But very interesting. Also, I thought that point you made also earlier on, just talking about COVID and the impact on yourself in terms of looking around you and trying to think something. I thought, again, that really linked into that great old Schopenhauer quote, you know, the task is not so much to see what no one's yet seen, but to think what nobody's yet thought about that which everybody sees. I think such a great quote, which rings down the ages. In terms of the time we have left, because we are obviously beginning to the end of this, it's been such a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much, Andrew. So go on then, just in terms of what's, again, coming up for you in the, should we say, short to medium term future. Go on then, what are you up to?
Well, you know, maybe going to South by Southwest.
Hopefully so.
If people make a big enough stink, I don't know. That would be lovely. I was quite looking forward to that, and a little let down that we were passed by, but whatever, I get it. You know, I'm a little bit at loose ends. Work is kind of quiet, but that's not the worst thing. Because I can, you know, get back to some things I've been avoiding. I'm actually writing another book, probably my first proper book, my first McLuhan, very McLuhan book. And you'll never guess what I'm calling it, Sean. It's going to be titled "The Medium is the Message."
Very good.
Funnily enough, Marshall never wrote a book with that title. There's "The Medium is the Massage."
Yeah, indeed.
Which was... you know, it wasn't really much of a McLuhan book. It was more a Quentin Fiore book. But Marshall never used "The Medium is the Message" as a book title, so I figure I can do it. you know, taking that's right. Maybe I'll get away with it.
That's right. And then it's Understanding Media, wasn't it? Was the
right, exactly. Yeah. But my book, you know, when I started the McLuhan Institute back in 2017, I decided I'd focus on this phrase, "The medium is the message," because, well, it might be kind of low hanging fruit. You know, a lot of people have heard of it, and a lot of people have difficulty in discovering exactly what it means. But, I truly believe that, our world would be a different place if more people understood that, the medium more than the content is the shaping force. Mm. So I've been paying a lot of attention to how and where and when Marshall uses this phrase. I tracked down the first time he said it, which, you know, a lot of people attribute it to Understanding Media in 1964, mm-hmm. but he actually first said it in 1958.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me. I attribute one of the causes or inspirations to something that happened in October of 1957. And that was the launch of a satellite we know as Sputnik.
Mm.
Yep. And Marshall would later say that at the moment of Sputnik, ecological thinking became inevitable. And the medium is the message is an ecological statement. So 6 months after Sputnik, Marshall says the medium is the message. And I believe the two things are connected. Mm. So then I've been sort of creating a timeline across the years of the different times and ways Marshall uses the phrase, because I find the easiest way to help people get an understanding from the statement is to see the different ways Marshall used it.
Mm.
It's very helpful. Once you read a few of them, you know. It's also encouraging because when Marshall first said it, and for the decade or two or three after, people said, you know, the medium is message, like, okay, you're crazy.
Mm.
And now you say the medium is the message, you know, the environment is a shaping force, the technology, yep. almost regardless of the content, is what changes us personally and socially. People are like, well, yeah, you know, it's obvious.
Yeah.
And so that gives me some hope. But so the book charts when he first said it, the times he said it in the between years, when he last said it. And then, you know, my closing essay, which I'm working on, is to sort of speculate whether the medium will always be the message and what that might mean going forward. So I, you know, my lack of employment at the moment gives me the time and space to do things like that. So I think that's what's most pressing on my plate for the rest of the year.
Very good. And in terms of all things time and space related and shaping forces and connectivity and all of that, of course, one of those great points that, again, that Marshall came up with was the global village. And there's, I think, very little signs of that going away, although the village may not be as calm as one would like to put it, again, not too hopefully glibly, but one has hope for a happier future. Well, what can one say? But that's been such an interesting conversation. Thank you so much, Andrew. So again, make sure everyone's utterly clear where they can track you down, because I know you've also got a fantastic newsletter. So go on then, just to let everyone know where they can find you.
Oh, thank you. Yes. You may have heard this thing called Substack. You know, I have a Substack newsletter called the McLuhan Newsletter. It's very imaginative, but easy to find for all that. I'd love it if you subscribed. I'm actually, one of the things that came from this Girard conference, I met somebody who works at Substack, and we were talking about, you know, what makes one newsletter popular over another, what makes, you know, how influencers are made, and you know, the few upsides and the many downsides of that system. So I'm working on a post about that, which unfortunately keeps growing. So I'm going to have to figure out a way to maybe turn my poetic self on it. The McLuhan Newsletter, please, you know, subscribe. You can even throw some money my way for it if you're so inclined. You can go to the McLuhanInstitute.com. There will eventually be something at TMITM.com, which stands for The Medium is the Message.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully tying into the book, I'll put something up there. But I also have a Twitter page for the McLuhan Institute, which is a really valuable resource. I've been spending a lot of time putting the pithiest, most interesting, sometimes lesser known McLuhan quotes there. So have a look there on Instagram. And, you know, you can reach me at andrew@themcLuhanInstitute.com if you care.
Fantastic. And I'm sure everyone listening will care a great deal, and will also be banging on the door of South by Southwest, digitally or otherwise, to insist that they get that identity panel back on. But really, I think all that leaves for me to say is to Andrew McLuhan, a poet for hire who writes, teaches, coaches, consults about culture and technology from a McLuhan perspective. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Sean. It's been a pleasure answering your questions.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.